Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out! It's only films to be buried with.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I am a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a fortune cookie poet, and I love films. As the scientist Thomas Trowdre Chamberlain once said, falsity in intellectual action is intellectual immorality. And if you ask me, The Day Trippers is a forgotten gem of American independent cinema. Profound words there from Thomas Trowdre Chamberlain. For this very special New Year episode, I decided to do my films of the year. I always wait till January to do them, as I've been burnt before by calling them too early. I'm looking at you, little Miss Sunshine. I wanted to do it with a previous guest, and there were many candidates to choose from, but I do know that Scroobius Pip does his own countdown of his favourite films on his Distraction Pieces podcast, so listen to that. And most of the other guests I've had on here have more of a life, and they don't see everything, which really only left one guest, which was, of course, Nish Kumar, which isn't so bad, is it? I was genuinely delighted to run through our favourite films together. Please come and join me over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you can help out the podcast and get loads of extra content, including videos, guest list tickets to live shows, recommendations, and all sorts of other great stuff. From this episode alone, there are 3 extra questions that Nish and I discussed, including best opening and closing sequence of the year, that are only available to Patreon members. And best of all, if you become a Patreon member, you don't even get this bit about being a Patreon member. I cut this bit out. You just get the episode completely unencumbered by ads and stuff like this. Give it a look over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. And for those who really want to take a deep dive, I will be publishing an exclusive 11-page article on my top 26 films of the year only on Patreon. So do check it out. It's just the top 26. It's no big deal. Oh, and 2 other announcements. Friend of the podcast, director John Drever, and I will be doing a Q&A at a special screening of Superbob at the David Lean Cinema in Croydon on Tuesday, 15th of January. So look that up and grab the last few tickets that are available and see it as it was meant to be seen on the big screen. And there is one more big announcement before we get on with it, and that is I will be doing another Films to be Buried With live at the BFI on Tuesday, February 5th. Tickets will be available from next Tuesday, which is Tuesday the 15th of January, so get them while they are hot. That's all the admin. Well done, everyone. So, here we go. Brilliant Nish Kumar and myself and our films of the year. Big warnings for this episode. There are some very heavy spoilers here. If you've not seen the films discussed, we obviously think they're good ones, so be careful if you haven't seen them. I think you're mostly fine, except for the film Roma, which we go into a lot of depth about, so maybe watch that before you listen. And there are some very dark subjects discussed here and sensitive issues explored. So if you are easily upset, feel free to skip bits that make you uncomfortable. But don't skip everything or you'll miss the troubling bonus section. And it's a really good one. That is it for now. Finally, here you go. It's the bloody episode. It was an absolute treat to record. So sit back, relax, and I very much hope you enjoy this Films of the Year special episode of Films to be Buried with Mr. Nish Kumar. Hello and welcome to a Happy New Year, very special episode of Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. Good evening. I am joined today by a returning guest back from the dead.
Back from the dead.
He's a very special guest. He's here from the Nish Report And from the Soho Theatre, please welcome to the show again, it's the brilliant Nish Kumar. I have invited Nish Kumar here to discuss our films of the year for a Films of the Year special. And the way that we're going to do this is by answering some of the usual questions of the show, but only 2018 based.
2018.
And the rules of this are, it has to have been released in the UK January 1st or onwards up to December 31st.
Yeah.
Which really threw a spanner in the works when Nish reminded me last night that Lady Bird was released this year.
That's a big one.
And fundamentally changed my top 10 that was already. So we're going to do some questions, we have a little chat about his films and what matters, and then we're going to end with our top 10 list.
Great.
Is that right? Oh, I forgot to tell you.
What?
Remember when you were crossing the road reading a tweet about Brexit and you got hit by a car and killed?
Yeah, yeah.
As in the film One Magic Christmas by Disney, starring Harry Dean Stanton, I, like an angel, popped in and removed you from the road into a sort of parallel universe where you get to live for one more day this year.
That's
Bear in mind, at the end, you will be sent right back
straight
to that
back down. Yeah, straight spot. Back down. Oh, that's very revealing of how I see my afterlife prospects, Brett. I auto-corrected to straight back down. Straight back down. He's not. Even I don't think I'm getting into heaven, Brett.
God, that's what straight that, through the this report persona.
That's what that... I didn't think about that. I felt myself saying it, and I was like, oh, you've gone with down.
Straight back down.
That's interesting. Straight back down.
Straight back down. Here he is. Nish has very kindly invited me to his flat to record this, and may I say on record, it's an absolute shit sty.
Can I just say, it's a lot cleaner than it used to be, and my girlfriend, who also lives here, will be very upset because she's made quite a lot of effort to sort of sort the place out.
I am not a clean person, and I feel, in comparison, like that woman... The Japanese lady who's got a new Netflix show.
Yeah, the Netflix, throw everything in the bin.
Yeah. I feel dirty. Sat here, I feel like I'm going to... It's disgusting.
We're sat in a sort of... sat in a particularly bad pile of stuff. For the benefit of acoustics, we've sat in my bedroom amongst, I mean, what can only be described as a 1997's worth of CD. Like, My bedroom basically looks like Our Price Records in the 90s.
There's nothing in the bedroom, if I may say, that would indicate it's a bedroom, since the bed is so covered in in stuff that you're not sure it is a bed, and if there's a person living in it. I don't know if your girlfriend is under that stuff.
Anyway, I haven't seen her for weeks.
We can cut this if you like, because it's...
No, I don't.
But, but what we do realise is where all your enormous brain goes is on your work, and definitely not on...
Yeah, we did the last one at your house, which is, as anticipated, the home of a serial killer. As I'd expected for knowing for all of those years.
I did make you sit on the plastic sheeting.
The Zodiac killer. Brett lives with Dexter. As anticipated.
I did answer the door wearing gloves. anyway, here we are. Now, Nish and I...
Yeah, and we really do. And we've deliberately avoided recording this in December when a lot of the top 10 lists came out. You had a specific reason why you didn't. What film was it?
Well, I used to I have a stand-up routine. You can find it on YouTube about it, but it's very serious about how I had done a sort of top 10 of the year list very late December.
Yeah.
And it had Little Miss Sunshine at number one.
Yeah.
And then I believe on like Boxing Day or 27th, I then saw Pan's Labyrinth. I was like, oh, fuck.
You know, Pan's Labyrinth effed you.
I'd put that top 10 out in the world as if Little Miss Sunshine had won it, and it was an absolute travesty. And I think, I'm amazed by people who put out... Some people put out top 10s early December. Who are these maniacs? Mary Poppins Returns hadn't been out yet.
That specifically was the film that Brett... Because I said, should we do it in December when everyone else is doing it? And Brett said, no, Mary Poppins Returns is coming out, so I need to... I need to make sure that Mary Poppins Returns... I haven't seen Mary Poppins Returns.
Listen,
have you seen it?
I have seen it.
How was it?
And it's wonderful, but unfortunately, because of the reminder of Lady Bird, it's not made the top 10.
Oh, really? Lady Bird killed Mary Poppins?
Lady Bird killed it with her Sacramento ways. So, yeah, so we're recording this January 7th. We've had enough time to actually see all the films of the year.
And process them.
And process them. To be clear, The Favourite, which we both absolutely love, will not be on this list because it officially came out on the 1st of January.
Yeah, it was one of those, American Hustle was like that a couple of years ago, where they released it in four cinemas in late December. But The Favourite did officially come out 1st of January.
So unfortunately it's not eligible for this year, but I'm very sure it will be here next year, so keep your eyes out.
Yeah, let's not do the thing that we specifically said that we weren't going to do and start talking about The Favourite. it's a great movie. I've also seen Vice as well.
And I've seen If Bill Street Could Talk, which I think will probably be number one next year.
But
so early to call it.
Very early to call it, Brett. Very early.
Come on, there's still time for Pan's Labyrinth 2. or Mary Poppins Returns. So, shall we get cracking on... Because I thought, instead of just doing a list, which we definitely will do at the
end. Yeah, which we are doing, to be clear. We're fun guys, but we're not that fun.
And by the way, I've actually done a top 25 list, which will be available somewhere on the internet. Probably for patrons.
Can I see it?
If you become a patron. Okay, so let's start with what film scared us the most this year?
I think I know what yours is going to be.
What do you think it's going to be?
I think it's going to be Hereditary.
You're absolutely right, it's Hereditary.
I haven't seen Hereditary.
Okay.
Do you want to know why?
Yeah.
Too scary.
Yeah. Well, you're sort of right. I mean, Hereditary's made my top 10 list because it is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking. But it's so scary that I almost don't want to recommend it to anyone. I literally had the lights on for a week.
Right.
And it upset me. It was so scary. Like, it went beyond, like, oh, it's fun to be scared, isn't it? To, like, I think I need therapy.
Did the Exorcist comparisons hold up? Or is it a different sort of...
I don't have the feelings for The Exorcist, so to me it's much scarier than The Exorcist.
Right,
The Exorcist never scared me.
Right.
Because I'm well out. No, The Exorcist, I don't know, I appreciate The Exorcist, but I don't find it particularly scary. This was horrible. But
right,
I think, I'm sure I've talked about this before, but I think what makes it special, this film, aside from everything, it's just so well made, is that he holds on the aftermath of terrible things.
Right.
So the terrible thing happens, and that might make you jump or go, ooh, like it would in most horror films. But then he doesn't leave the room.
Yeah.
And
sure.
He sort of stays on what the emotional fallout of that moment is.
Right.
And it's so upsetting. You just it sort of sinks onto the characters and onto you that you just go, oh God, this is so horrible. And then you're stuck in that mood for another hour and a half. I mean, I do not recommend it, but it's absolutely excellent.
Toni Collette for Best Actress?
She should certainly be on the list.
She doesn't seem to have picked up the heat so far.
Well, it's horror, isn't it? I think horror and comedy are the same thing.
Yeah,
and
sure.
It is exactly that thing of comedy of, it's so subjective. Because literally the man next to me when Hereditary finished said, that's the worst film I've ever seen. And I've only had
conversations with people who found it terrifying to their core.
Yeah.
Or risible.
It's very much the same as the film Vacation.
The National Lampoon.
The new Vacation. In the,
what with that
so many people hate it. And so many people come on this podcast and tell me it's the greatest comedy ever made. So, you just don't know. What is your answer for the film that scared you the most, Nick?
Well, like, my horror tastes are much more subdued, I would say, than yours. Like, I'm very easily scared.
Right.
So I ended up not seeing Hereditary because I saw the trailer and thought it was so frightening that I basically sort of ummed and ahed about seeing. It was at a time of year where I couldn't really go to the cinema in the day, which is very infrequent for me,
yeah.
And that is mainly when I'm at the cinema.
Yeah.
And by the time I got round to it, it was only on night screenings.
Oh,
and
no.
I thought, I'm not doing that.
Forget it.
I'm not doing that. I can't do that to myself.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen it yet. But I saw A Quiet Place.
Excellent.
And thought it was great.
Yes.
And it really frightened me. And I thought it was...
But manageably.
Yes. Manageably-ish. I still saw it in the daytime. I thought it was a really brilliantly put together film.
Yeah.
Not what I was expecting from John Krasinski.
No. Well, what were you expecting? Lots of looks to camera.
Yeah. I certainly thought... Also, he has directed a couple of films before that
has
are...
He?
What's more what you would expect.
He's done like sort of romantic comedy.
They're sort of, I think one may have been an adaptation of a David Foster Wallace novel. But there's certainly more hyperverbal comedies. But I didn't anticipate him co-writing and directing a horror movie. But it had lots of good jump scares. Yeah. But it also has, I think the thing that, it has real stakes to it.
Yeah.
I think that's what I really appreciated. It's, and I mean, this is something that is going to come up a couple of times. Once you kill a kid early in a film,
yeah,
that you have established real stakes.
We're on board.
Yeah, we're on board.
Yeah.
And I thought that I found it quite, I was very sort of persuaded by the whole thing. Like, I know that a lot of people have commented on the fact that she gives birth in complete silence in a bathtub, and that's ridiculous.
Well, but if you were a Scientologist, that's normal.
Yeah, if you, yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, that's me imposing my non-Scientology. Yeah.
Don't bring your non-Scientology views here.
But it's
your non-Scientology agenda to this conversation.
Yeah. But I went along with it. I bought into the whole premise of it. I bought into all the central relationships. I thought she was great.
Oh yeah.
And
but
I think
the birth thing is, I think, why it's brilliant, because
yeah.
it's the hardest thing to be quiet.
Yeah, through. Yeah.
That's why it's so
it was, yeah.
high stakes.
It was there were plenty of jump scares, but the emotional stakes were also there. And
yeah.
so you really feel the bonds of the family. I thought she was really brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think she is someone who is slightly undervalued as a performer. I've seen her be excellent in very mediocre things, like The Adjustment Bureau. She's
right.
really great, and it's not a good movie. She's also great in Edge of Tomorrow.
I
which
love
is,
Edge of Tomorrow.
It's a very underrated movie.
Such a good film.
It's such a good movie.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, I thought she was brilliant in it.
She's great, and it's great, and I love that film, but I did, and I'm sure this has been said, but I did spend the whole time thinking, one fart and you're all dead. You're all dead.
Like,
I hope no one's cooking chickpeas.
The thing, I mean, I'd be dead minute one. I'd be minute one of Quiet Place. All that would happen is, I'd like...
Walking around that shop,
dead. Either that or I remember a Simpsons episode. Dead. one like my laugh would
yeah
but then also I mean I couldn't decide whether my laugh would either result in me dying or if it's such an unpleasantly high pitch that it'd be
that
one of the things that kills the aliens. I'm either
you're the secret
immediately
the
dead or the secret weapon in the plot of A Quiet Place. What it also really reminded me of is people be fucking
yeah
even people be even and to be absolutely fair to him
yeah
it does feel different with a condom on, but I would say, under the circumstances of A Quiet Place, pop a Johnny on, Krasinski. Pop a Johnny on. Think
I
through.
I haven't even thought of that.
Think through the ramifications.
No, it's a foil wrapper. Put it under a towel. Very quietly.
Very quietly.
Very quietly undo it. Slip it on. Just make a...
Yeah, exactly.
Do it.
There you go. No problem. But yes, I did. I mean, I was very scared by it. And also, when I saw it in the cinema, they'd done the turn your phone off, like a special Quiet Place.
Oh, really?
Turn your phone off. Not, and that I love that sort of thing. I the whole experience of it was really great and really exciting. And I saw it in a kind of semi-packed cinema.
Yeah.
And everybody really embraced the
yes.
no talking, no rustling. It was a really excellent experience all around.
Yeah. It was really impressive that everyone yeah. I saw it with quiet and everyone put down their popcorn. We're like,
yeah.
oh, fuck that. We ain't having
yeah,
popcorn.
Yeah, yeah. And the ending, it has a great final shot.
What's the final shot again?
Her cocking the shotgun. Mm. It's just, that's what I liked about the movie was, it's just ridiculous enough.
Yeah.
But I was so on board with the kind of characters and their struggle that by the end, her cocking the shotgun, I was like, fuck yeah. If somebody told me this movie ends with her...
With Mary Poppins
pretty,
with
Mary Poppins pretty much looking down the barrel of the camera and cocking a shotgun
yeah.
to shoot a bunch of aliens in the face, I'd have said, absolutely not. No, thank you. But by the end, it's such a stressful film.
Yeah.
And they've been under so much strain that by the end, I was right with it. But it had the great combination for me of like jump scares and emotional stakes that I think you
it's
need
really
to stick with the horror
and
movie.
Also... Proper Hitchcockian suspense.
Yeah.
Putting the nail in the staircase.
Yeah.
It's so
the
brilliant.
The nail just in the staircase was a great piece of... Because
yeah.
you... It's a real trick to pull off. When that nail happens, you go, she's going to step on that.
Yeah.
Like, that's gonna happen. And yet, somehow, they make a virtue of you knowing that that's going to happen.
Well, it's that whole thing. You know that thing? I'm sure you know it. Hitchcock used to say the difference between surprise and suspense. Surprise is a bomb goes off. You didn't know there was a bomb there.
Yeah.
And suspense is there's a bomb under the table.
Yeah.
And now we're having a scene.
Yeah,
and like the nail is a bomb under the table. We now know.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. There's a bomb under the table, but everyone's just going to keep having dinner. And you're suddenly really stressed through dinner. That's why I love Inglourious Basterds. It's just 20 scenes of bombs under tables.
I'm obsessed with...
with loads of chat.
I mean, I do really like it, but... to me, I can take it, I don't need to sit and watch it from beginning to end. I can pick a scene.
Yeah.
Because it is basically four people are talking, one person has a piece of information, and everyone else doesn't know if they have the piece of information. Yeah. And like, it's that over and over again. So I don't need to sit and watch it from beginning to end. It's like, oh, I feel like watching the Michael Fassbender version. It's like an anthology movie.
Yeah, it should be called Bombs Under Tables.
It really is.
Okay, what is the film that made us cry the most this year? A lot of contenders in this category.
A lot of contenders this year.
You go first.
A lot of teary films. Well, look, this is going to reoccur in a couple of categories, but I think it's pretty much immovable. So I went to the cinema. I phoned you immediately after I saw this film.
Yeah.
I'd gone to the cinema with the express intention of seeing Roma and then Shoplifters straight afterwards. And I came out of Roma and I was so distraught that I didn't go and see Shoplifters.
Yeah, and I think because that was wise.
I went to see Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, that was the right
side note, great movie.
Yes.
Really great movie. I found Roma genuinely distressing.
Yes.
And it's not really an experience I've had a lot in the cinema. Being in a packed cinema where loads of people are crying.
Yeah.
Normally, you and I are quite similar in this regard.
Yeah.
In that it doesn't take much.
Our bar for tears at the cinema is very low.
No, the Hulk in the Avengers, at the end when he says, what's the secret is that I'm always angry. Our secret is that we're always crying.
How do you do that?
I'm always crying.
Permanently on the verge of tears.
Yeah. But Roma, and I mean, the sequence that we're all talking about is the dead baby.
Yes. Now, maybe this is my answer to a different question. Maybe we do this now.
Yeah.
Get out of the way. I don't know. Will you tell me that you've finished
I just found the whole thing an almost unbearable and overwhelming emotional experience. I had a bad feeling about it.
Yeah.
Because I cried the first time I saw the trailer. But right. I think that's just because he manipulates... The trailer is one of the great trailers for a foreign language film where no one speaks, so you don't know it's a foreign language film. And he used The Great Gig in the Sky, that Pink Floyd thing. So that is a piece of music that's designed to, you know, manipulate your emotions.
Yeah.
But I just had this sense of the movie was going to do something to me. And just from minute one, I was just running low-level tears through the whole thing. But it all kind of builds to two crescendos. There's a scene where she delivers a stillborn baby in the hospital, which is, appalling. It's such a hard scene to watch. But then the end, and again, it goes back to that thing of, if you've killed a baby, why wouldn't all the kids die at the end?
Yeah, exactly.
There's no reason that all the kids wouldn't be dead at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
So when she goes into the water, which I still, by the way, don't understand how they shot that.
Don't know how they did it. And also, apparently she really can't swim. Yeah. So I was like, how'd they do this scene?
I don't understand. I mean, her performance is so much a bedrock of why that movie, I think, is so incredible.
Yeah.
And her face is just... And he knows it as well. And he uses the close-ups on her face so incredibly in that film. And when she goes into the sea at the end, you know, and I think in the back of my mind, I remember the poster image, which I thought was sort of a pity that they kind of spoiled the end, because the poster image is all of them hugging on the beach.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And in a way, it's a shame that they did that. So on your way into where I saw it in the Curzon in Soho, you see that poster on the way in. So there's a part of you in the back of your mind that's like, oh, hang on.
I forgot about that. I thought they were going to die.
That's the only thing that saved me from... At one point, I thought I was going to have to leave.
Yeah.
Like, I was crying so much because it's just an emotionally overwhelming... It's kind of... That film contains absolutely everything.
Yeah.
It's like, it's, you know, it's race, it's class, it's gender, but it's all of those kind of social issues told through the most incredibly human story. And I don't know, I think you should, that film should be used as like a sort of test of basic humanity. I think it's such a human film, and it's such an emotional, and it kind of, it has its heart on its sleeve through the whole film.
Yeah.
And by the end, that kind of crescendo where you think they're all going to die, she saves them. And when they kind of collapse on top of each other at the end, and she, the line where she says, you know, I didn't want the baby, that absolutely broke me. And what was interesting for me is it was a packed cinema because there were so few screenings, and all the people around me were gone as well.
Mm.
All the people around me were gone because it is, it, like, you're crying on three different levels. I think it's like tears of like joy.
Yeah.
Because they all really love each other. Tears of sadness because this, it's a really horrible thing that she is admitting.
Mm.
And also it's like tears of relief because 30 seconds ago you thought there were going to be three dead kids on the beach. It's like an incredible, overwhelming tidal wave of emotion at the end of that movie.
Yeah. It's my answer as well.
Is it really?
Yeah, you can have that.
And is it the same bit?
Yeah.
Or is it just generally
I'm going to talk about it on one of the other questions, actually.
Yeah.
But Roma made me cry. Also had, when I saw it in a packed cinema, four people walked out in that hospital sequence. And one of them was pregnant, and I thought, oh, this is a really bad date movie you've been brought to.
Yeah, and do you know what? Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, the one thing we should talk about with Roma, which is Netflix. God bless them for giving it money and stuff.
Yeah.
There is no way that is a film to be watched on your laptop.
Yeah.
That is absolutely a cinema film.
Yeah.
And it's such a widescreen film, big film, sound design, 360, all this stuff. And I keep reading people on Facebook going, oh, I got bored with Rome, I gave up, what am I missing? And I go, well, you're missing not seeing it at the cinema, is what you're missing.
Almost
it's too much.
Yeah.
I can't imagine watching that on your telly. It's too, it's too slow, and it takes its time, and you have to get into it and lose yourself in it. And I think watching that in your kitchen on your laptop, of course you're bored. You're not in it. You're not letting it sort of work its magic on you. And it takes its fucking time. We need more cinema films.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Stadtsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right. What is the film that is meant to be shit, but you loved it this year?
Okay, I'm going to go with my own preconceptions about a film.
Yeah.
Blockers.
Oh, fucking Blockers is brilliant.
I thought Blockers looked like a complete bag of shit.
Yes.
It was sort of called Cock Blockers.
Yeah.
I thought the premise sounded appalling.
Terrible. Yeah.
I fucking loved it. I loved it.
It's really good.
I absolutely loved it. Between this and Lady Bird, it has been a great year for relatable teenagers in films.
Yeah.
I thought that the teenagers seemed recognisably young. And I always have a problem with teenagers on film in that, A, they're often 30.
Yeah.
And B, they're always really sexually confident, which is not like me and my friends when we were growing up.
Or now.
Yeah, or now. But it was genuinely funny.
Yeah.
Leslie Mann is brilliant.
Magnifique.
And also, Ike Barinholtz sort of, I guess, undiscovered depths in this movie.
His big speech is one of my scenes of the year.
It's
such a great bit of writing and acting.
I always knew he was funny, but like, and then there are performances like Hannibal Buress.
Yeah.
He's just purely hilarious with his jeans pulled up. He's purely hilarious in that movie. Yeah, it completely caught me cold. I saw it on a plane.
Oh, great.
And just it completely, and I have rewatched it on land to make sure that I didn't have plane madness.
Yeah.
Like there are some movies you watch and you're like, that's the greatest film of all time. And then you get back to sea level and you're like, that's a bag of shit. There's something about, but I have rewatched Blockers. I thought it was
You've voiced in the correct atmosphere.
I thought it was very sweet natured.
Yeah.
And
it's got good messages. And I hate saying that, but it's got really good messages.
It's got very good messages, but again, you don't realise you're being preached to. Like, it's sex positive. It's got a nice feminist message running through it. But because the characters are so well drawn and well observed, and John Cena, it turns out, is really doing a lot to sort of banish the memories of Hulk Hogan in films.
When are they going to do a John Cena is a big man with babies?
Looking
after babies film.
That's covered. What was yours?
Well, mine was, and again, this is a tricky one because I feel like it was half loved and half hated by the critics, and then the Golden Globes were last night and it won everything, but it was going to be Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because I almost wasn't going to see it.
Yeah.
I'd sort of heard lots of bad things. I knew people had liked it, but I'd also heard critics hated it, and it's although it definitely the tide seems to be changing. And I'd heard a lot of people I know like hated it, and I wasn't going to see it. And then I spoke to John Robbins, our friend John Robbins, and I said, who is a massive Queen fan, I said, do I need to see Bohemian Rhapsody? And he said, yeah, it's brilliant. And I was like, oh, is it? And I went late on my own, not that bothered. And it was one of them films, and it's a bit like Mamma Mia in the same way, where for most of the film I was watching it going, I think this is quite bad. I think it's quite badly written.
Right, sure.
And quite badly sort of told.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I'm absolutely loving it. Like, and it's a special kind of thing, and I can't quite explain what it is.
Yeah.
Because I can't... If you tell me that you think it's shit and bad writing and stuff, I'll go, yeah, it is. But I loved it. I'm so happy here. I was not bored. I was very entertained. And it's very simplistic. I can see all the arguments against it. I agree with, but I'm having a lovely time. What are you all complaining about? And then it does this thing at the end. This is not a spoiler, but the end is the Live Aid sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is phenomenal. It's proper cinema. And they do something. And I went home and watched the original Live Aid to see sort of what they'd done. I was like, why did that feel so special and amazing? And the original is amazing. It's a great fucking gig they do. But what they do in the film is not only make it visually dramatic and swoop in and out and all that stuff, but I think it's the fact that in a fake way, possibly, they've manipulated the story so that this concert is not just for Africa and for charity and whatever. It feels like it is literally for his life.
Right.
It's almost set up like this is the last concert he's going to do. And I know that's not true.
Yeah, sure.
But they raise the stakes so much that it feels so moving and powerful and fucking amazing, this sequence. And you go, that's what cinema can do. It can make something mean more and be bigger than it was. And I think the end, that sequence is 5 stars.
Right.
Okay. Regardless of anything.
Yeah.
But the rest of the film, and it's very well acted. All the acting is very good. And there's lovely, there's this simplicity in it.
Yeah, sure.
There's a bit where... You haven't seen it, have you?
I haven't seen it, no.
So there's this is a spoiler, but they sort of break up for a bit. And when they come back together, Freddie Mercury says to the band, when he's trying to make up to them, he goes, the worst thing that happened was when I went solo, I was in a studio with loads of great musicians and stuff, and I told them what to do, and they all did it. And he said, and that's the problem. And he said, and I realised what makes us is the compromise between all of us.
Yeah.
And I thought... As simplistic as that is, it's a very nice way of looking at the reality of the collaborative nature of art and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, it's a fucking lovely film. But I can't tell you it's complex and it's just really entertaining and great.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's been received in such a mixed way.
I think it's that people want a different film.
Yeah,
than it is people like, it should be more complicated about his sex life and all this stuff. And I go, there's 100 films you could make, but the film they've made... It's lovely.
Yeah,
it's a nice time.
I know a few gay people who have seen it.
Yeah.
And they've come away from it going, it does feel a bit like they're saying, oh, he should have been straight.
You may be right.
The thing is, I can't really comment on because I haven't seen the damn movie.
No, I felt like it wasn't that. I didn't take that from it, certainly. Sure. But I'm not saying that's wrong. But I definitely felt it was, you know, it's a very sanitized...
Right.
Sure, we don't see any... It's all very... The whole film is very clean and PG. Yeah. And but again, I don't think it's untrue.
Sure.
Well, who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's very... I'm sure there's a much, like, filthier version.
Yeah,
and
sure.
A sexier version and all sorts.
Yeah.
But it's very nice what it is.
But it's very interesting because it really... Yeah. I mean, we are recording this the day after the Globes.
Yeah,
and it like... Yeah.
That's surprising. I mean, I don't think it's that good. But it's good. It's a nice time.
Yeah.
And that's not a crime. Right, here we're at the heavy one, which is, what is the film that meant the most to you this year because of the experience around the film, not just the film itself?
Yeah, sure. It is a tricky one to bring Roma back into it again. But I'm so happy Netflix is funding these kind of things.
Yeah.
But I wish they would give longer cinema releases.
Yeah.
Because that film was such an advert for the power of the medium of cinema.
Yeah.
And
being in a group of people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Experiencing that film in a room full of people was a reminder. And seeing, you know, it's a fucking work of art. Every frame of that movie is like, you know, you could break that film down frame by frame and just put it as a photography exhibition.
Yeah.
Like it's an astonishingly photographed movie.
Yeah.
And like he did it himself, cinematographer.
Yeah.
You know, like it's a reminder that you're really dealing with an absolute master of the medium. But I just thought experiencing that on the big screen was such an important and powerful experience.
Yeah, agreed.
That it was, yeah, and I found it was such an overwhelming eruption of everything that is possible in a film. And seeing it in a full room with everybody kind of going for it and being moved by it. So it was a reminder of why we love movies.
Yeah.
And I think it's great, like, as we said, it's great that Netflix is funding these things. I wish they would give them a slightly longer cinematic run. I just wish that we would... You know, I saw Private Life as well.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful movie. And it's great to see Catherine Hahn getting such a meaty lead role. You know, it's a small personal movie that's about human relationship. I mean, the only way I can sum this up is the whole plot of Private Life is someone has a bad idea and it goes badly. Like, that's the plot of the movie. But it would have been great to see that on a big screen because you are going on a journey with these characters. And even though it's quite a small, intimate movie, they photograph bits of New York really beautifully. And it would have been great to have more of a crack seeing that in the cinema. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which...
I love that.
It's not in my top... I adore the Coen brothers, and I really... But the piecemeal nature of it means if somebody honestly said to me, is that one of the best films we've seen this year? I'd go, the Tom Waits bit is one of the best times I had in the cinema. But as an overall experience, I've never quite watched an anthology movie that I've come away from and gone, that as a whole experience was very satisfying. I enjoyed elements of it. But again, the photography of the Tom Waits thing, that is built for the big screen. And I just wish they would give it more of a run. And like seeing Roma on the big screen was an overwhelming experience that reminds you why the sort of mystery and power of cinema that captured you as a child, it reconnected me with that, watching it.
Yeah. My answer is also Roma. but this is very serious. This is a very serious answer I'm about to give.
Yeah.
And I want to, before I say this, that I've talked to my parents about this before discussing it on here to say that it was all right to discuss it. And basically, you know, Roger Ebert, who the great film critic, he always said that cinema is this big empathy machine.
Yeah.
And this is to do with that scene in the hospital, which we've already discussed, a massive spoiler, which is that the lead character has a stillborn baby. And the way that it's shot, I remember feeling like it's one of the most like harrowing sequences I've ever seen. And that to the point of, for a while, I almost felt like it almost shouldn't exist. And I was thinking, why did I feel that way? Like it was sort of so powerful, but I felt almost wrong, like it shouldn't be there. And I was thinking, it's because it's part of a testament to the film that we've become so attached to these characters that it feels what's the word, like, private.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't be there. That's how I felt. I felt we shouldn't be watching this. Yeah, it's too private. And here is the thing. My mum and dad had a stillborn. Their first baby was a stillborn. And I've always known that. And it's not that I've been unsympathetic to it. It's always like, oh, I knew they had a stillborn and they had a miscarriage and they had my sister. But I think seeing that film, it really, it made me see it. You know, it made me see it. And you go, fuck me. Like, what a horrendous thing to experience. And it also, I hate to sound old, but it sort of made me appreciate my mum and dad more because I was like, fucking hell, you went through that.
Yeah.
And you're not completely mad. like you're mad. But you're and also you went through that and you're not talking about it every single day. you never going, well, we had a stillborn, so we've struggled. The fact that they don't, it's not part of their, they're not victims, they're not hold on to it. They appreciate what they have and everything, but you go, fuck me. That is such a sad thing to fucking experience and to just see it in that scene. Like I say, it's not that I didn't know it.
Yeah.
And it's not that I hadn't had sympathy, but it increased by 100 times the feeling I had towards it.
Yeah.
And genuinely made me appreciate my mum and dad in a way that I hadn't, I think. And that is pretty impressive for a film, you know what I mean? For a Netflix film.
Yeah, I mean, that is... it's funny because it...
Because I called them afterwards. So I called my mum and dad afterwards. And I'd said... I sort of said... I think you should see this film, but equally I want to warn you before you go because, and this is what I mean, this is the woman who walked out at the screening I was in was pregnant and I thought, I wonder if she should have been warned.
Yeah.
Because it's so, so upsetting in a way that not many scenes are. But I think it's that, it's the fact that you feel you shouldn't be looking at this, it's too private. I don't know, but anyway.
And also, you've, by that point in the film, we're so invested in her particularly, that it does feel like a sort of personal bereavement by that
point. Yeah, and just the reality, and I don't think anyone is unkind in the scene, but just the sort of practicality of the doctors, that they're like, hold the baby, we have to take the baby away now, you know, it's just all quite, practical. It's like, we have seconds here, the baby's not breathing, you need to hold the baby, we need to take the baby away.
Yeah.
And just that sort of like, fuck me, you know.
But that, I mean, that is extraordinary. That is the sort of, I mean, that is the kind of power of film.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've never heard that quote before. That's amazing. The empathy machine.
Yeah.
That is an amazing thing. Imagine you come away from watching a movie about people that don't exist with a deeper understanding of your own parents' trauma. Like, that's extraordinary.
God, makes me want to cry. Beautiful, isn't it? Right, let's move on to, obviously, my favourite question. Sexiest film of the year.
Okay. This is going to sound bad
Aquaman?
When I say it initially.
What is it?
Okay. Shoplifters. Now, hear me out.
Okay. Now. Shoplifters, about a lot of children.
Hear me
Keep
out.
Going.
Hear me out. Before everyone calls the police.
And that's all we've got time for. Thank you, Mitch.
Brett, I'm really taking a lot on trust here. You're editing this podcast. You can make me look real bad. Shoplifters. Yep. I love the kids.
Okay. And
There's a sex scene in Shoplifters that I think is... the sexiest scene I've seen in a film in ages.
Yeah.
It's the two... And it's a difficult film to talk about because so much of what you think you understand in the first half of the movie gets pulled away from you in the second half of the film.
Yeah.
But the characters who you, at that point, think are the mum and dad...
Yeah.
They've already had a conversation with the woman you think is the sister.
Mm.
And she has already asked the dad point blank, like, so are you guys still having sex? And he says, no, you know, we're past that. Like, he suggests that they've reached a level of intimacy that means they don't need sex.
Yeah.
And then they're both indoors. All the kids are out. It's raining noodles. Outside. Eating noodles.
That's the what least... did you on the mic.
Yeah. I love ramen. That's what I've got. Absolutely all for ramen. But it's like at the start of the scene, when she's just sat there, they're both sat. It's like... they just both sat there in the indoors and it's like they're both in their underwear, but like as soon as the scene starts, you're like, these two are about to have sex.
Yeah.
But it was like, it was the most, it was sexy because it was the most like human and honest sex scene I've seen in a film for years. And like afterwards, there's not a lot of sex scenes that embrace the kind of comedy of sex. Like, sex is an intrinsically hilarious thing. certainly the way I do it. But it's an intrinsically hilarious thing. But then afterwards, when he's just sat there naked and smoking,
yeah,
and he's just sat there being like, I did it.
Yeah.
I didn't think I could, even I didn't think I could do it, yeah. But I did it. There was something so intimate and warm in that scene. And it was like, it's the most realistic depiction of sex I think I've ever seen. And it was titillating in its ordinariness. And it was really beautiful.
That's a really good answer.
What's your sexiest film?
My sexiest film is The Old Man and the Gun. Have you seen The Old Man and the Gun?
No.
Very sexy.
Robert Redford
one. Yeah, Robert Redford walking around being sexy. And Sissy Spacek and everything's cool and the music's all sexy.
Yeah.
And it's all really laid back and cool. And you just think, oh, this is great. I want to have sex with it.
Who are you finding sexy in that? Is it Robert Redford or Sissy Spacek, or is it both of them?
Yeah, they're just very charming and twinkly. And you just think, yeah. And there's like this boop, 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 which is the soundtrack I play during sex. Boop, 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 pow, pow. I did it. Pow, pow, pow. It's just a real, like, I don't know how to, it's just sort of, the atmosphere of it is sexy. Like, but sexy, like, what's the equivalent? I don't, like, Out of Sight is sexy.
Yeah. That's one of the horniest movies of all time.
And it's kind of, it's his and her charisma and, like, his whole thing. And they only do a little kiss in it. But it's enough.
Right, yeah.
It's a great, yeah, you're like.
I mean, I get what you mean. Yeah. I mean, also, it's Robert Redford and Sissy Spacek. Yeah. So it's like, it's two sexy people.
Two sexy people being sexy with sexy music.
Yeah. But also, like, confident robbers are really sexy. Mm.
Tell me about it.
Confident robbers are really hot.
That's charming.
A real subgenre Pornhub category. True.
Confident robbers who aren't going to hurt you.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
They're going to charm you. They're going to charm you out of that money.
Are you saying that it's basically Out of Sight plus 30 years?
Yeah, it's like old Out of Sight.
Right.
It is a lot like Out of Sight.
Right, okay.
God, imagine that. Imagine old age Out of Sight. That's still what it is. So that's my sexy answer. We've got the subcategory, Travelling Boners Wearing Ride-Ons. Do you have it all?
Yeah, Tessa Thompson's performance art piece in Sorry to Bother You.
Oh, that's a great answer.
Yeah, it was a... I'm ashamed of
that. That's a very honest and great answer.
I don't feel good about it.
No.
Because it's a performance art piece about objectification of women.
Mm-hmm. And you absolutely loved it.
Hook, line, and sinker. Apologies to everyone.
Clapping for it. Yeah, very profound with a boner. That's a really good answer.
Yeah. I mean, there's a more troubling version of that, and that is being aroused by the horseman. But
yeah,
that's, you know. What's your troubling boner?
Well, I suppose my troubling might be Charlize Theron in Tully.
Sure.
She does a lot of breastfeeding.
Oh, that's very troubling, yes.
She's very tired and exhausted, but she's so beautiful. But I kept thinking, yeah. And I remember it's sort of sometimes, sort of you get the impression it's meant to be like, oh God, look, she's really ugly to herself up for this part. And I was like, nah.
You can't.
She's still a very beautiful. Is that troubling? It's slightly troubling. I've said it now. It's not worse than your one, which is a woman having shit thrown at her.
Terrible. So, terrible scenes. Worth appreciating Tully, though.
Yeah, great Tully.
I mean, Sorry to Bother You, also a great film.
Yeah,
I suspect possibly features in both of our top tens.
I believe it does.
I thought it was... it was a really...
Oh, no, it's number 11.
Is it really?
Because you put Ladybird in. Ladybird's really upset the cut.
Saoirse Ronan has absolutely kneecapped.
Just kicked.
A couple of movies.
Sorry to Bother You out.
I loved Sorry to Bother You. I thought it was really funny and really inventive. But also, Tully, you and I, huge fans of Young Adult.
Young Adult.
Very excited to see Tully.
Yeah.
Slightly unheralded?
Yeah.
How good it is,
sort of. Yeah, kind of... Don't think enough people seen it.
Yeah.
Same as Young Adult. What's wrong with it?
It's both of those films are worth seeking out.
Yeah, in that order as well.
Yes, yeah. That sort of holy trinity of Theron, Reitman and Cody, they seem to bring the best work out of each other.
I look forward to their old age, Young Adult, Old Adult.
Yeah, yeah.
In 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea that those three check in on each other and make a film about kind of...
Yeah, like Before Sunset,
It's but Tully was a really lovely, and I mean, I I'm not really a good barometer of this because I historically am very bad at picking up on quite obvious twists, but yeah. I really didn't see the twist coming in Tully. I really didn't see it coming at all.
I think that's nice. You were trusting.
Yeah, I am really trusting. I really embrace. But I
get sort of annoyed when people go, oh, I guess that. It's like, why are you guessing? Just watch it. Just let the thing happen.
I was completely, gone with it. I wasn't looking for a twist. And so I was completely blindsided by the ending of that movie.
But if you do watch it, don't look out for a twist.
Yeah.
Just enjoy your life. What is the film you most related to this year?
I think you know the answer to this already.
Is it Roma again?
It's Roma. It's Roma from my time of doing naked karate. The naked karate scene. One of the great comedy scenes in a film this year.
Yes.
Like, at a surprising...
And a surprising moment.
A surprising moment. The film I've related to most this year is Lady Bird.
Oh, that's my answer.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That's weird.
Of course it is.
Why did you relate to Lady Bird? I mean, we have talked quite extensively about Lady Bird. What was it?
Well, I think that Lady Bird is the perfect example of, which should be like taken on by any writer, is the more specific you are, the more universal it is. Because it's so specific, Lady Bird. It's so about her town in Sacramento. It's so about her school, her Catholic upbringing, her mum. This whole world is so detailed that I thought, that's exactly my upbringing.
Yeah.
I am a teenage girl from Sacramento who had a Catholic upbringing. I've never felt more... Oh, I'm Lady Bird.
Yeah.
Oh, totally get Lady Bird. I'm all Lady Bird.
I could not agree more.
Yeah.
I.
And just to be clear, just for the listener, because you can't see us, we're not young women who grew up in Sacramento Catholic high schools.
Yeah.
That's the twist.
Yeah, that's the...
That, you didn't see that?
That's the twist of Lady Bird.
Yeah.
Is that she grows up into... A bearded 30-year-old man. I 100% agree. I mean, Lady Bird, there is also quite specific things in terms of I'm the exact same age as Lady Bird.
All the music in it.
Going to a crappy house party where Cry Me a River is playing. Like, I had that experience.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've related to a character as much almost in any film I've ever seen as I did with Lady Bird.
Yeah.
And also the tenor of her relationship. I know from people that have seen it that it's a great mother and daughter movie, but the tenor of that relationship is exactly what my parents were like, except they were both like that.
Right.
So it's like quite a sort of, we all exist.
They're both the mum or the dad?
Both the mum.
Right.
We exist at quite a stressful pitch. We love each other very much, but we exist at quite a base level, stressful pitch of the way we interact with each other. But I think it, I was also that kid, you know, the drama kid who's not quite good enough to play the lead. You know? And also that sort of mouthy, opinionated, confident, but then occasionally her vulnerability and the fact that she doesn't know anything shows through. When the scene where Chalamet sat on the car boot, and she said, I mean, and also he's one of the great teenage douchebags.
Yeah, he's so good.
I'm trying not to engage with the economy. It's like one of the great pieces of teenage bullshit. But he, when he says something to her and she is like trying to flirt with him, and she responds by saying, well, if you don't, I'm going to kill your fucking family. Like, that is... They do it all in one shot. It's a brilliant performance. She says it.
Yeah.
You completely register that she's trying to flirt with this guy. It fails. And in the single shot, you see her say it, realise it was terrible, and go, oh, Jesus, what did I just say? In one shot. It's a great...
So good.
It's a great performance. And, yeah, I related so hard to Lady Bird in that movie.
And I love this storyline of the dad. I love how the sort of details of the dad is revealed and... It's just a really brilliant film. And also what is really lovely, I'm sure you know this and have read it, but you should look for it, is that to get all the songs she got the very big songs from the time. She wrote love letters to Justin Timberlake and to all of them. Have you read those letters?
No.
It's so lovely. Like, just from her. Just going, dear Justin Timberlake, I loved you so much.
Really?
And I would really like to. We can't afford you.
Is there any way
we could have your song? And got them all. It's really nice.
I think it's a perfect movie.
Yeah.
I really think it's every decision that's made in terms of the look of it and that slightly golden tinge on the frame and everything feels like it's a memory.
And there's something really original, deliberate. Like for a film that is, I suppose you could just say, well, it's a coming of age film.
Yeah, sure.
There's something I've never seen before, which is what happens at the end. Again, this is sort of a spoiler, but yeah. The sort of realization she has at the end, I don't think I've seen that realization yeah. before. And there's the thing where she goes to uni and she gets horribly drunk. Yeah. And then she goes to church the next day. And the film is so sort of complicated and three-dimensional. It's not really, I don't think, about faith. It's not that she missed God.
No.
It's that she missed her home and what she'd, the things that she'd never appreciated about where she's from.
Yeah.
And as a teenager has tried to escape and rebel against all this stuff, is being away from it, she suddenly realises, oh, it was a lot of it was really fucking lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was beautiful.
I had a really, as I was watching it, the first time I watched it.
Felt the same way about Saturn. Go on.
I think the more we talk about it, the more you realise actually you and I have that experience of like growing up in a place that's a bit shit, but sort of on the way to interesting places.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, it's kind of, you're looking at interesting, and we both grew up in kind of the suburbs of that South London.
Yeah.
And that feeling that you're pressed up against the glass looking at the interesting, exciting party is massively frustrating. But I had a really, when I was watching it the first time, as the ending, as she started going to New York, I was like, I don't need this. Yeah. I don't need this at all. And then immediately afterwards, I was like, I'm so glad I got that. I'm so glad.
Yeah, exactly.
It turns out Greta Gerwig knows more about making films.
Yeah, you thought, oh, it's an ending. Why is it going on? I 100% agree.
It was such a great thing because you're like, we don't need any of this. Yeah. The film should be over. Oh, no, wait. That was the best bit of the film.
Yeah,
I don't know anything of what I'm talking about. It was that.
I didn't guess the twist again.
But also, normally when people make films about their hometown in that way, or coming of age films, it's normally either this was the greatest time of my life or this was a complete shithole. And somehow in Lady Bird, you come away with her going, it was a shithole. Like, it is kind of a boring place, but it was also
great,
really beautiful and really wonderful and you really love it and stuff. But yeah, I related almost too much to some of that movie.
I like that the guest I've chosen for this film is my mirror. And all the answers are the same. Okay, well, I mean, if your answer is not Roma, the next question is, what's the greatest film of the year? The greatest film, not necessarily your favourite film.
Well, I think in terms of just purely on a kind of technical, I'm not even on a technical level, it's Phantom Thread.
Oh, okay.
I would say it's hard for me to split Roma, Lady Bird and Phantom Thread.
Okay.
I think, and the reason that I'm always happy to talk to you, Brett, but the reason I'm particularly happy to be talking on this podcast is I think it's been a great year going to the movies.
Yeah.
And I think part of the thing that has made it such a great year is I think those are three legitimate classic films, like as in they're legitimate contenders for my favourite films of all time. Like, and I've seen all three more than once, and they all hold up in their different ways. And it's very difficult for me to split them up. So I'm going to split them in the slightly arbitrary way of saying that Phantom Thread is probably, as an outsider, possibly the greatest of the three. Not necessarily my favourite, but possibly the greatest of the three. Just because it's a great final performance, possibly, for Daniel Day-Lewis, although we have been burned by this retirement chat before. But he is so brilliant in it.
I think it's his best, yeah.
I think it might be his best. I think it might be his best.
Because also his subtlest.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's his funniest.
Yeah, so funny.
The thing that I think is so wonderful about Phantom Thread is it presents as being something completely different to what it is. It looks like a very august period piece that's a focus study of a brilliant and troubled artist.
Yeah.
And actually what it is a black comedy about
codependent,
fucked up relationship.
Yeah.
And it is possibly a two-hander. I think you can make the case that it's a three-hander.
I think she should get the Oscar,
Leslie Manville. Leslie Manville is so incredible in that movie.
Yeah.
And I think it had kind of a mixed reception at the box office. But because I think it was publicised as, it looked boring.
Yeah, it looked boring.
You know, I went to see it because I fucking love Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
And you went to see it for the same reason.
Yeah.
And also weird people who love movies.
Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, and love Paul Thomas Anderson. But I thought, The reason I think it's the greatest movie is it's like, it completely confounds all of your expectations, and it is two of the great artists of cinema working possibly at the top of both of their games. I think it's probably Daniel Day-Lewis's best performance, and I think it might be Paul Thomas Anderson's best film. I think it's so extraordinarily beautifully shot. It's so wonderfully put together, and everything about it, the score, the way that it's shot, suggests this kind of epic, swooning romance. And then at the heart of it is this horrible little black comedy about two people who are trying to destroy each other. And it's such a perfect distillation of everything that he's done in his career. Like, he's one of the most beautiful assemblers of an image. You know, like, he knows how to compose an image so beautifully, and he knows how to get the best out of actors, but he also knows how to put this unexpected, dark, bitter heart in the centre of all of his movies, and he has a wicked sense of humour. And I think it all comes together. Everything that he's been moving towards comes together in Phantom Thread.
You can have it. I love that film. I love Paul Thomas Anderson.
It's such a good movie.
I also love that he... I sort of have written a joke about this somewhere, but like, that every film he does is so... It must be so mad living with him that he'll wake up one morning and go, oh, I've decided to make a film that's completely different, set in a different world, in a different age, a different country, a different thing, about fashion designing. And his wife must go, what? You don't know anything about any of those things. Yeah, I'll do some research and I'll make a fucking masterpiece, but completely different from the last one. Like, what?
I also love...
proper artist.
But in interviews, he seems like such a normal bloke.
Nice man.
He just seems like a normal man.
He said on Adam Buxton's podcast, he said, yeah, I used to, like, not really get the work-family balance right, but eventually you realise you're just making a piece of plastic to go on someone's wall. And I thought, wow. I mean, he's not wrong.
He's not wrong.
But what a piece of plastic.
What a piece of plastic that sat in my living room right now. Okay. What's your answer?
Well, it's so difficult. I narrowed it down to four, and I thought, well, I'll put them in different places. But
yeah.
My four are First Reformed, sure, Roma, Cold War, and Shoplifters. But I think for all the things that we've discussed, I'd probably say the greatest.
Yeah.
Let's say the greatest, I'll go with Roma.
Yeah.
For all the reasons we've discussed. But it's not my favourite for all the reasons we've discussed.
Yeah.
Because I don't imagine watching Roma a lot.
Yeah.
I admire it tremendously, and I think it's an amazing achievement. But I wouldn't want to take it to a desert island.
Yeah.
I may never want to see it again, or certainly not for a long time, because it was so much.
Yeah.
But I do think it's an extraordinary, brilliant, you know, technically everything film.
So which of those four do you think... Oh, well, that we'll talk about that.
We'll talk about that. So my greatest, I'd probably go Roma, because I also think it's... Yeah, fuck, is it?
You think on a technical level and storytelling and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I guess. But do you know what's weird is I haven't really talked about it, but First Reformed.
Talk to me about First Reformed.
You've not seen it?
No.
I went to see that. It's short.
Yeah.
It's like, it reminded me weirdly of the film 45 Years, which is one of my favourite films.
Oh,
in that it's quite, it seems quite slow. It sort of starts, not that slow, but like you're kind of, he described it, Paul Schrader, the director, as a passive-aggressive film, in that he said, I'm sort of daring you not to get involved.
Right.
Because it's quite sort of austere, and Ethan Hawke is a priest in the middle of nowhere, and he's just sort of writing in a diary, and it's all quite cold and unemotional, and it slowly, slowly builds and builds and builds and builds, so that in the space of an hour and a half, when it gets to the final scene, you're clawing your hair out with fucking, like... Oh my God! You know what I mean? And it's done it really like stealthily.
Right.
It's just dragged you in really slowly, like, come on, come on, it's all going to be nice over here. And I loved it. I really loved it. I loved everything about it. And I don't really want to tell you much because I think you should just see it. But it's, I suppose, the thing is, when you're talking greatest, the reason Roma seems like so ambitious and has so much in it. It's got politics, it's got family, it's got, you know.
It's also got a huge amount of his life in it as well, the more I read about it.
So I think it's, I'm probably picking that just in terms of kind of, but then Cold War, it's got 40 years in it, fuck.
I feel like we haven't talked a lot about Cold War. So,
God.
You know, that's a film that I watched and quite enjoyed, and the more I sit with it, the more I enjoy it on reflection.
Cold War's
brilliant. Very similar...
It's very similar to Phantom Thread.
Phantom Thread, yeah. It's a great year for... two people destroying each other.
Yeah. for really realistic unhealthy relationships.
Yes.
And shoplifters.
Shoplifters,
which we'll come to, but I think that all three of those films say something about love that I don't think is said a lot. And A Star Is Born, by the way, the love, and I believe there is love in all of those stories, isn't what we might romantically call pure. There is, what's the word? There's conveniences and there's advantages to all of those relationships to the people. So in A Star Is Born, there's advantages for Lady Gaga to be with him at the beginning. It helps her career. Doesn't mean she doesn't love him, but it is part of it.
Yeah.
And in Shoplifters, which we won't spoil, their relationships are useful to each other. In Roma, she works for them. It doesn't mean they don't love her, but she also works for them. And in Cold War, they equally have uses for each other within it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean they don't love each other. And I think that's so probably realistic and right and rarely addressed, because we usually, in stories, love is just pure. You just, oh, we were just meant to be. Yeah. Whereas this seems to say, life is fucking messy and complicated. Yeah. And sometimes it doesn't mean you love them any less. It helps that their life helps you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. But I would say, of the lot of those, I found Shoplifters the most warm of the lot of them. And actually, Shoplifters, I found the kind of disillusion of the relationships in Shoplifters the hardest to bear, because it's such a brilliant movie because it doesn't sit in judgment on any of its characters. And I came away from it thinking it would have been better if they had continued to live in that way.
Oh, 100%.
But even the lead actress in Shoplifters, it's a shame with people like her and the lady from Roma that there is always going to be this bias against performances in a different language. Like, it's you can, as a director, you might get recognised. And
that's
as true. You know, you might even, I mean, we're a couple of weeks out from the Oscars. It might even win, Roma might even win Best Picture, but the performances, like, and the lady in Shoplifters, that performance is absolutely extraordinary. Yeah. And by the end, her character is unconvinced that it was a good thing. Like, she doesn't sit in judgment of the decisions that are taken in the second half of that movie. But I felt it was a real wrench. Also, I think Phantom Thread, of all of them, they are the couple best suited to each other.
Best suited to each other,
When, at the end, the line,
I want you flat on your back.
No, when he says, kiss me.
Yeah.
That is the closest I come all year, and possibly in my life, to standing and applauding a film. I just thought, so few people would have had the courage of their convictions to just go, you know what? These two are fucked up.
Yeah.
But they might just have found a happy way of living in this kind of cycle of literally poisoning each other.
Yeah. Fuck, it's great, isn't it?
But I thought, I know what you mean.
It's been a great year for complicated relationships.
Complicated love.
Complicated love.
Yeah.
I haven't really answered the question, but I'm going to.
I think you have with Roma.
Yeah. We don't like to be negative for the show, so we'll do it quickly. What's the worst film of the year?
Robin Hood.
No, I did not see Robin Hood. And part of the reason I didn't see Robin Hood is I felt Robin Hood, something was up, because they didn't advertise Robin Hood.
No, they really snuck it out.
It sort of went, Robin Hood's out. What? Nothing.
They really snuck it out. It was.
What happened to Robin Hood?
I mean, here's the thing. I grew up loving the Disney cartoon. I love the story.
We all love Prince of Thieves.
We all love Prince of Thieves. This movie is so bad. Like, it's so unspeakably appalling. It just, from minute one, at points it feels like they're trying to make it look like a video game. The plot is completely incoherent. The tone is all over the place. And the worst thing about it is that it's really boring. It's like, it's really, really dull. And I don't know why. I mean, I do know why. I'm sure he's paid really well for it. But, like, Ben Mendelsohn is such a good actor that he does not deserve this kind of weird late period turning up in movies and just being
bad.
It is so bad, it made me long for Russell Crowe's wandering accent.
You've got bad ears, mate.
You got shit ears.
You
got shit ears. I'm going to walk out of this podcast in tribute to Russell Crowe's publicity tour for the last Robin Hood movie. A terrible film that is better than That Shit Show.
Why can't people make Robin Hood anymore?
I don't know.
Why are people trying?
Well, I think it's the sort of... And I love him, and I love the Batman films, but it's a sort of post-Christopher Nolan obsession with things being gritty that I think misses the point of those Batman films in that, yes, they are... They did sort of try and put some recognisable realism. But if you go back and watch them, they're fucking fun movies. Yeah. And they're movies that don't skimp on spectacle.
Yeah.
And I think that watching things like the Justice League movie and Man of Steel and Batman and this iteration of Robin Hood, I think people have watched those movies and gone, right, what we need to do is put mud on people and make the camera shake a bit. And that's a film now. Great.
Also, it's appropriate for Batman to be dark and moody.
Yeah.
It's not appropriate for Robin Hood. Robin Hood is a fox.
It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And I mean, I think they were trying to... And they were... The attempts to kind of bring contemporary relevance in.
Mm.
Like, oh, he's been out fighting a war in the Middle East. Where's that happened before? When's that happened? And he's come back and he's been forgotten about.
It
really ladled it on. What's your worst film?
My worst film is Shane Black's The Predator. And I love Shane Black and thought he could do no wrong. And here's my hot take on The Predator.
Yeah.
The Predator is absolutely mad. It's a mad film.
I didn't see it.
Oh, okay. I thought you'd gone to see it.
No, I did.
It's
basically got put off by people telling me it was
I'm
shit.
All for mixing things up, but there is a tone to The Predator where it's like a kid's film. And there's a kid sort of lead character. Within this kid's film, there's people being hacked up into bits and stuff like that and sort of bad, sexy banter. But the kid is autistic and it's sort of done like that's his superpower. And it's sort of done like a joke, but I'm not sure it is a joke. And then one of the lead characters, his joke is he has Tourette's and that's the joke.
What?
And there's lots of things going on all at once, none of which makes sense. And it's genuinely impenetrable. You watch it going, I don't know what's happening scene to scene. I don't know who's the predator. What's the predator after? Why are they now on a bus? Who's that? What's this autistic kid's superpower? Why is the Tourette's guy now dying and everyone's crying? What's happening?
Is it a reboot? Or does it exist within the world of the Arnie movies?
That's a good question. I mean, honestly, I don't understand what it is at any point. I think it could exist in the world if the world of the original one was also a kid's film.
Yeah, sure.
And also, it's mad. It's really genuinely sort of astonishing. Like, it's one of those films where you go, well, it must have got to the deadline and everyone just went, oh, fuck it, that'll do.
You say The Predator is the equivalent of my GCSE geography coursework.
Yeah, just like, well, this doesn't make any... Oh, the execs, everyone must have been at a screening going... Oh, I mean, we're out of time. There's no time to fix this because it doesn't make any sense. And it's not like not making sense in a way like I quite enjoyed Batman vs. Superman because it was like a German expressionistic art film. But like, because it was so like, my theory on Batman vs. Superman is that the edit was done.
Yeah.
They were in the edit. It was final day. Everyone said, great, we've done a great film. Print. And instead of pressing print, they accidentally pressed shuffle. And then it went to print. Because there are scenes in that don't make any sense in the order they're in. But it's sort of fun trying to piece it together. Whereas Predator's like...
I don't understand Batman vs. Superman. Because that film is as much a dream... There are as many dream sequences in that film as Inception, I think. Like, and it is... I do not get that film. If you're saying to me the Predator is worse than Batman vs. Superman...
The Predator is I didn't enjoy in the way that I enjoyed Batman vs. Superman. Batman vs. Superman's an art film and I'm all for it. But The Predator, I just think
this is the theory.
Mess.
This is the hot take no one can get behind.
Yeah. Funniest film this year?
Game Night.
Lovely, lovely film.
I mean, Blockers is up there, but Game Night... I mean, Sorry to Bother You and Lady Bird are also up there in terms of... They're both comedies.
Mm.
I guess Game Night might shade it because it doesn't have any other agenda, really, other than a comedy. But... I've seen a lot of mediocre films with Jason Bateman, comedy films with Jason Bateman. Great to see him in a proper comedy. In a good one.
That he co-wrote.
Did he co-write? I didn't actually realise that. It's properly funny. Rachel McAdams is hilarious.
She's great.
She was really funny. And then again, you know, people like getting Sharon Horgan in, getting properly funny people. Chelsea Peretti has a really funny cameo in it.
Yeah.
And I just thought the script had proper jokes in it. It set up some really terrific... I don't think I've laughed more in a scene this year than when Rachel McAdams is trying to remove a bullet via a YouTube tutorial from Jason Bateman's arm. And I am also like, I'm pretty root one in a lot of my comedy tastes. And people nearly being sick but not being sick will always make me laugh.
And he's got a squeaky toy
And he's got a squeaky toy in his mouth. Right. It's just one of those things where everything's set up and there's two scenes where people land on glass tables and they don't break. And in the second scene, one of the characters goes, wow, glass tables are behaving really weirdly tonight. And it is so funny. I thought it was great. I thought it was really great.
I think that the funniest film... Well, I had two is Black Klansman.
And, oh, yeah.
And Sorry to Bother You, both of them.
Right.
Made me laugh a lot in their funny bits.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Black Klansman is underrated as a comedy, as in it's shocking and made me furious by the end and really upsetting. But there's so many genuinely funny sequences in it. And in that way of, I suppose it's the laughter of shock, of just going, fucking hell. But both of them, Sorry to Bother You and Black Klansman, made me laugh in a similar way.
Yeah.
Like, maybe not as many laughs as something like Game Night, but big laughs when they came.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
I think that's fair. Also, Lakeith Stanfield, the Peter Bradshaw's The Guardian film critic, described him as someone who has been... He's constantly like someone who's been awoken uncomplainingly from a nap. Like, I think he's so good.
Yeah.
And, he's really funny.
Okay, to finish, as promised, and we're really just going to have to rattle these off because we've got to go. Nish, what are your top 10 films of the year?
Okay, this...
In order.
...will always change. Yeah. I don't think... As I look at it, I think, I fuck this up, but I'm going to go with it. 10, Coco.
Great.
We've not even mentioned it.
We haven't missed it. We haven't got time. Just go to the list.
9, Widows.
Yeah.
Game Night.
Yeah.
Cameron Post.
Yeah.
Sorry to Bother You.
Mm-hmm.
Black Panther.
Yeah.
Shoplifters,
yeah.
Lady Bird, Phantom Thread, Roma.
It's a lovely list.
That's my 10.
My list today, guys. This is an insert. So at this point in the actual recording, I said my top 10 films of the year. And as I was saying them out loud, I thought, this is a mad list. Why are you saying this list after everything you've discussed? And I always change my mind. I change my mind so many times. But at some point, you know, I'm locking this down when I say this on the podcast. So because I own this podcast, I can do what I bloody like with it. I'm inserting over what I originally said, what I now think are the top 10 films of the year. So here they are. For the record, it was the same films as I said to Nish, but they were in a different order. And I thought the order was wrong. So here we go. This is it, all right? And yes, it contains loads we haven't even discussed on the show. So you just got to watch them all. At number 10... 120 BPM. Did we mention that? Oh my God, you've got to watch that. Number 9, Hereditary. Ugh. Number 8, Coco. Number 7, Black Klansman. Number 6, Phantom Thread. Number 5, Lady Bird. Number 4, Roma. Number 3, Cold War. Number 2, First Reformed. And of course, at number 1, Shoplifters. Is that it? I think that's it. That's it. I think that's it. That is it. That is definitely my top 10, I think. All right. Get back to Nish. That might all change when I publish the results. Do I agree with that?
I don't know. I think you should fix it at this point. But what? No. As in, I think you should set that in stone now. Because otherwise, I think it'll never end.
I mean, Lady Bird definitely needs to be higher. I've got to change.
I can't believe Phantom Thread is
bringing
up the rear.
I'm going to have to do a re-record at the end.
But I just...
Where I say...
It has been a really great year because if you think about it, we didn't talk about Coco or 120 BPM. Didn't even have time.
No. Listen, guys, I am going to publish my top 25 and the 10 might be different from what I've said here. and that will be on patreon.com, /Brett Goldstein. You must join. Nish, if you want to look at it, you have to join.
I'll do it.
Nish Kumar. What an absolute joy you are.
What a delight,
I've loved this. Thank you very much for having me in your disgustingly messy flat. I now immediately return you to the moment where you're about to get hit by a car reading a Brexit tweet.
Down I go.
And I hope you carry on and have a lovely time in heaven with your film.
Well, I've apparently consigned myself to hell.
Oh, yeah, heaven. That was it. Hell, hell, back to hell. And thank you very much. You're a joy and a delight.
Thanks, Brett.
And, what a year.
What a year. Well done, everyone.
So that was our films of the year. Hope you enjoyed it. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Join the community over there. Tell them your favourite films of the year, etc. Find some other treats. And remember to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating because it helps our numbers. You know how I feel about numbers. They're very important. Give us the numbers. Thank you very much to Nish for doing this. What a joy. Thank you to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the artwork. I will see you next week for one of my favourite episodes I've ever recorded with the magnificent Jesse Cave. But in the meantime, have a happy new year, have a good week, and please be excellent to each other. Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant.
Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva Presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my name is Maureen. Yeah, thank you.